Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. With me in the studio is Professor Mary Darmanin, who is the project leader for Malta for a project entitled Religious Education in a Multicultural Society. Welcome, Professor Darmanin.
Thank you.
This obviously is a very topical issue, multicultural societies and religion. Perhaps you could tell us sort of how the project came about and why.
Well, this is a FP7 funded project, EU 7th Framework project, and it's one of the small to medium scale projects. It's usually the call would be for people in academic field, different universities, who are interested in any one of the topics. Now, this topic, religion and religious education, comes under the topic cultural interactions and multiculturalism in European societies. And the interest in it is, of course, the changing nature of European societies. Most of them are incredibly multicultural. Ours is becoming multicultural, but has been less so. And the interest would be usually also not only to contribute to knowledge on how we can improve life for European citizens, but also how we can capacity build European academics, so through the involvement in the project. The members of the project team would be training new researchers, sharing ideas, developing a research capacity, which would also feed into the EU policy-making field, of course. In this case, policy-making on education, policy-making on human rights, because religion is one of the rights, religious freedom is one of the rights that is guaranteed both at the international level and even at the EU level. So that is usually the impetus. How it actually came about, I have colleagues who know my work and I know theirs in different universities, and the project leaders approached me and asked if I would be interested in being one of the members of this group and coordinate the Malta project. Through it, I will tell you in a minute, we've got the Economic and Social Research Institute from Ireland, the University of Edinburgh in the UK, University College Dublin, also Ireland, the European University Institute, which is currently in Italy, but it's a European institute, the Higher Institute of Labour Studies, Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, Dortmund University in Germany, and the University of Malta. So we're seven partners in this project. And, it's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yes, in fact, I have been involved in a couple of EU projects, and I know that it's not easy to coordinate the work of several universities. It's several universities, several people within that university. So it would be interesting for those who perhaps aren't so familiar with the workings of the EU projects to explain a little bit how this networking actually
works.
Takes place.
Well, I must say, unless you have a good coordinating team, and in our case it's the Irish partners, both the ESRI and University College Dublin, but also Edinburgh, together they worked on the proposal, and actually a lot of the work is done at the proposal stage. That is, the people who are making the proposal have to know the field very well, because they are going to make a research plan and they are going to propose a budget. And then at that stage, you contact the other universities. And in the case, for example, of Malta, apart from my input from the academic, I needed the help of the EU support office, financial help. I didn't understand in budgeting, would we be getting enough money to actually carry out so we need legal advice. What are we committing ourselves to? Can we actually do it? So in fact, that process, the proposal, until you put in the proposal and get it accepted, It's about 6 months long, and you really need to have a very good support in your home country. Otherwise, you can't participate. Apart from which, you need support in your faculties, because obviously to do this, I do use the weekends and I do use the evenings, as academics
sure you do.
Yes. However, I need to have some support from my head of department and my dean of faculty. And actually, in Malta, this is something, both the administrative and at the academic, I think we need to have another look at to benefit more from, because we haven't yet got an infrastructure to give this type of support. I mean, recently I was asked to join a number of other projects, which had I known I had more support, I would have joined. But we still don't have, for example, a process whereby we can buy out our time. What do I mean by this? That some of the work which someone else could do, that I do, perhaps it isn't, you know, teaching undergraduates for the first year, more basic work, I can't pay someone else to do. So I have to fulfill all my academic obligations here at the same time as I am doing the project. In the meantime, I can employ researchers for the project, but for a lot of the project work, like analysis and even some of the data collection, it's better if it's a senior researcher. So here, just to give you an example, and the listeners can understand, that we're in a bit of a transition phase at the University of Malta. We would certainly be getting more EU projects if we could continue to develop this infrastructure. So that's just an idea of the proposal stage. Of course, once we've got to that, then we've got further hard work.
The proposal itself as well is another sort of a hurdle to
yes.
be got over. There's no guarantee that
absolutely
even after
not.
The coordinator and the partners have done all this preparatory work, there's no guarantee,
no,
of course, it's
no.
going to be accepted.
No, and in fact, the people who are putting in the proposal give a lot of hours to this work with no guarantee. The ones who are just going to be partners give less time at that stage. Again, it could be one of the reasons why in our case in Malta, we're more likely at this early stage to be partners rather than coordinators, because you really need a lot of time to be putting in proposals. Mm-hmm. But of course, it does pay off in the end if we start developing it would, because we would, for example, if I were to tell you something about the budget mm-hmm. of this project, mm-hmm. For Malta only, it's 104,000 euros for the project. Now, out of that, the EU contribution is 77,000 euros, which means that what remains, the Malta contribution, is probably just my salary, which I'm getting anyway. So the rest of it is being funded totally by the EU. And in this sense, you could see that, you know, the EU will pay overheads, will pay all sorts of things for a researcher. There's a lot of value added. It's bringing quite a lot of money in to Malta and even to the university. So we could really use these projects, apart from contributing, of course, to the body of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because there is now, has been in these last mm-hmm. months, a project office here at the university. However,
yeah,
you know, we're still a long way from...
I think it needs to quadruple in
yes.
the amount of employees.
Yes,
they're
I
very
think...
hard-pressed. Mm-hmm. They have deadlines all the time. They have to look at very, very serious legal implications and financial. So I think they need a lot of support so that they can then support
exactly.
us, obviously.
So, a little about the content of the project.
All right. Well, the content is looking at the transmission of religious beliefs and values across the education system and the family in these different EU countries. So, it is a comparative study. And it's also looking at the importance of religious denomination, in school choice. Is this a factor in school choice? Are parents choosing schools as a result of the religious affiliation of the school? It also looks at how the beliefs and values, and when we talk about beliefs and values, we are looking at people, of course, who also have no religious belief or value. I mean, they have values, other values, but not one to a religious affiliation. You might have people who are humanists, for example, atheists, agnostics. Of course, we're looking at all the faiths that you would find in Europe, Catholic, other Christian, Muslim, especially growing Muslim group in Europe, Buddhists, Sikhs, whatever. So we would be trying to have a look at how these children, what type of religious education they receive, whether it is leading to a multicultural society or whether it tends to be monocultural. looking at what type of value systems they have, and looking at the treatment of majority and minority religious groups, even those, as I said, with secular beliefs. So it's firstly, we started by looking at the diverse educational systems, and we've already written the literature reviews. Each person wrote it for their country, which in itself is quite a contribution. I mean, this took me a long time, I can tell you, but it was useful to know where are there gaps in the literature, what do we already know about our educational system from this perspective always. And then we had to write what we call country notes, that is, describing in a more descriptive rather than a literature way what's happening in our schools. For example, one of the things I found out when I was doing the country notes was, unfortunately, the later census did not ask people about their religious denomination. And this is where I think the Data Protection Act and its interpretation even more, really there is a serious problem. It is a misinterpretation of the Act to think you cannot ask people about religion. Why do I say this? Because if religion is protected in the Constitution and in other human rights legislation, and at a European level, so that no one can discriminate against a person on grounds of religion, you have to know whether a person is in a minority or in a majority. And if a person feels discriminated against, they can only make a case if that data is available. If the data is available, the person who feels discriminated against cannot make a case saying, I am in a minority, you have discriminated against me. So here, contrary to the belief that if we collect the data, we are infringing on their rights, it is the opposite. We are not protecting rights if we don't have the data. Apart from which, if we really want to make provision, both for majority and minority groups, we have to know what these proportions are. And especially so in it for education, we guarantee the right to education to every single child. And in guaranteeing the rights, we guarantee the right to a religious education. But how do we know we're not providing it, or whether we are, if we don't know how many people are not getting that religious education? So the census was an eye-opener when I was doing these country notes. Even more so going into the schools, when I was told that the schools now have a central information system, a computerized system for putting in data, age, nationality, sex, etc. We collect all that data, but we don't collect anything about the religious affiliation of the pupils, which again is a problem, because then you don't know how many pupils are receiving a religious education in the faith of their choice and how many are not. So this is just a little note.
This is a direct result of the data protection?
Of the interpretation, the misinterpretation of the Data Protection Act, because of course a lot of people who are working there don't understand the implications of research, and that is one of the problems, I think, with that office. But just to go on about the content of this study, the research will be carried out in primary schools only. We have a lot of information about secondary school pupils, about their interest in religion, European Value Study, Eurobarometer, all sorts of databases across Europe about older people, PISA studies and educational studies about subjects, how they're faring. But we have very little about primary schools. So we decided to focus on primary school, especially since we were interested in the link between home and school and how the transmission of religious beliefs and values the main socializers at that stage are home and school. So this is one of the things we'll be doing. I can tell you more about the methodology. I don't know how much
time. All right, just at this point, perhaps I could remind listeners that this is Patricia Camilleri, and today I'm talking to Professor Mary Darmanin from the university, and we're discussing a project which she's working on entitled Religious Education in a Multicultural Society. Do tell us about the methodology, because I think it's extremely interesting.
Yes, it is, I think. And for me, this is the bit I like most, because I really like doing ethnographic research. I like being in the schools. We are going to have case studies in each country. We're going to have five schools. In the case of Malta, the five schools, they have very kindly already given me access. Of course, again, the process is a bit long. You have to get, and quite rightly, ethical clearance, the University Research Ethics Committee, and then you have to ask the permissions from the Directorate of Educational Services and also from the church schools. So I will be doing field work in five schools. Two of them are state primary schools, one church primary school, and two independent schools. One of them is non-denominational, and the other one is an independent faith school. So these are the schools. Then when we're there in the schools, apart from some initial observation, of course we don't have a big enough budget to do a long-term ethnographic observation, unfortunately, because it would require a lot of hours to be in school. However, we will do a few days observation to get to know the ethos of the school, the culture, the teachers, and the children we'll be working with. It. I myself would never work with children without actually having done some time in their classrooms and getting to know them first. Again, because of the ethical implications, we have to first make sure that we have full understanding of all the participants, what the project is about, so that then they can give what we call informed consent. Children as well have to give consent, and it isn't enough to have the parents give consent on children's behalf, because often people think, you know, I'll ask the parents, and if the parent says, fine, you can film that child, you can talk to them, then it's all right. But really, the best ethical position would be to, once the parents have given consent for you to approach the child, that the child also has to be able to give consent, which means the child has to know something about what you're doing, that if they're uncomfortable at any point, unhappy with the questions, they can stop. They can leave the research
primary
project.
Level, I would imagine that's a little bit difficult.
It is difficult. You have to prepare materials, including pictures, that will explain what you're doing. And that's why the observation period, the time that I'll be in the classroom, is an important time for children to understand. And the preparation of materials for them to say, you know, and then they can tick and write or draw a picture what they feel about things, etc. So that is all the things. And when we're in the school, we will be having interviews, not the interviews that the type as if one was having a very fixed questionnaire, but we will have a schedule. We have to have a schedule of set questions, and then some which will be more open and some which will be particular to each country. But we have to have an agreed set of questions, because it's a comparative study. If I just ask the questions that I wanted to, and the partner in Germany and Belgium and Scotland asked theirs, we couldn't compare our data. So for this reason, we do have schedules of a certain amount of questions, and then we have an additional amount that we will continue to ask related to our particular context. So we will be interviewing the school principal, headmistress or headmaster, whoever it is, the teachers of the children we will be talking to. The children are in the age group 9 to 11. So their teachers, who are usually, in the case of primary school, the teachers also of religion. If they are not, we'll speak to them and the teacher of religion. If there is a religious counselor in the school, we'll be interviewing the religious counselor. If there is personal and social education, which usually does quite a lot of work of moral values and values and is a continuation, then again we will speak to that person. So in terms of adults in the school, about five. Then we're hoping to have the consent to speak to about 10 children of this age group in each school, so 10 plus 5, initially in a focus group, so that the children feel comfortable, can talk openly, but then individually. And the parents of five of those children. So if we have five children for the individual interviews, and all of their parents, a maximum of 10 parents for each school. This is what we're hoping. We're hoping as well that amongst the children and parents, we will have the sort of the whole profile of parents. So we will have Roman Catholic parents, Protestant parents, Muslim parents, parents who might not have a particular religion might be secular, humanist, or actually atheist, possibly, and any other religious minority that we would find in Malta, a small Buddhist, for example, minority, whatever, would also, but it's not easy, of course, to get in each school. Some schools, for example, in the church school, it's more likely that all the parents are Roman Catholic. Yeah. If I went to a Muslim faith school, it's more likely all the parents are Muslim. But in state schools and in other independent schools, there might be the opportunity to speak to parents with different backgrounds.
And would you be conducting these interviews always on the school premises? Do you get the parents to come into the school?
No, no. Or we will ask the parents. So far, I have only spoken to two schools to see whether they would make available a room. And then I haven't yet sent the letter to the parents yet, because I haven't, you know, the whole ethical clearance thing needs to go through. The parents will be asked what they prefer, either that they can have a home visit or somewhere else that they would
neutral
prefer.
Territory.
Yes, which is more quiet. If they want to, they can come to my home too. Mm-hmm. Or else at school. And then if the school offer their premises, but I haven't yet spoken to all the schools, you know, so it depends how they feel about that. Of course, we're trying to do our best to make parents feel comfortable. Apart from this, I will be interviewing some stakeholders, for example, the people responsible for the curriculum, the religious education curriculum. In the case, because we're a majority Roman Catholic country, over 90% of our children are indeed Roman Catholic, I will be speaking to the person responsible for the initiation of children into the sacraments, and that comes under from the Curia at the Catholic Institute. There is a special secretariat on this, on pastoral formation, etc. So those people will be interviewed as well. The imam, for example, because there's a Muslim community, a mosque, etc., has agreed to be interviewed, and other people who might be considered stakeholders. Some of these stakeholders are now part of an advisory committee. I have set up an advisory committee on the research. Again, sort of being concerned about the ethical aspect, the some details I don't know, like the ecumenical council that we have at the moment for Christian faiths. At the moment, they don't have a chairperson. They're in a transition, so it's a bit difficult getting someone to come. Someone from the Immigrants Commission to make sure refugees and their needs are addressed.
Several,
you know,
Coptic, for example,
yes,
refugees, Ethiopians, Eritreans.
Exactly. What's happening? So I asked someone to come from the Immigrants Commission, and the advisory committee will be meeting next week. So as you can see, it's quite a complex project, and there's a lot to do.
And I'm seeing also, hearing you talk about mm-hmm. various interviews you're going to be conducting, I can mm-hmm. just imagine the data that you're going to be creating.
I don't even want to think about it.
What are you going to be doing with that data? Obviously, there's going to be this comparison.
Yes, yes,
how
yes.
is it going to happen?
Well, we are going to transcribe it, and it will be then, because it's a digital recording, probably the transcriptions, if we can remove the identifying features because of confidentiality, they will be, the project has a website, and transcriptions and the data will go on the website. But then we have a stage of analysis. This is a two-year project. We started last January. We had the first planning meetings with the literature review, the country notes. This summer, in September, in Edinburgh, we planned methodology further. We had already planned it, but of course we went into more detail. We spent all September preparing the different schedules. Here in Malta, we prepared the one for parents. Each partner prepared one, but of course then we give feedback. This is one of the advantages, of course, of internet. And now we're going to start fieldwork mid-October. Fieldwork should continue till February, and after that it will be transcribing and data analysis. We have a meeting in April. We'll be meeting to have just our preliminary analysis, what themes, and then following that we will be writing different papers. We'll probably have two books from the project, one to do with the sort of the education systems level data, and another book to the ethnographic data. apart from that, different countries will be writing joint papers. So, for example, I have been invited. I don't know if I should say it now because I haven't yet asked for approval to go. I think I will because it's so nice and they were so good to me. University College Dublin, who are involved, have asked me, could I go for a second term Marie Curie Fellowship to them when I've finished my second semester teaching, I must say, for so more or less the summer, June and the rest of the summer, and write up a number of papers with them from this project, because they can see a lot of similarities between Ireland and Malta, and they would like me to actually be there in situ to write the papers.
So at the end of the day, you're going to have work on the project, you're going to have the data, you're going to do the analysis, you're going to have a publication to show for it at the end of the day. And also there can be some knowledge transfer.
I didn't mention that. I'm sorry. We've definitely got built into our budget that we will have local conferences where the schools and other schools, but certainly definitely for the ones who have participated, they will get the feedback and data. Of course, it will be anonymized. The ones who participated themselves will know. Of how parents and children feel about the religious education program. Apart from that, the stakeholders, like the present curriculum planners, the Division of Education, the Ministry of Education, which has also, by the way, been invited to be on the advisory committee, will get feedback to feed into policy making. You know, are we happy with our religious education in primary schools? What can we do about it? So the whole point would be, dissemination, apart from the website, there will be local conferences and we will disseminate at the local level, apart from the more academic work of the publications I mentioned to you.
So I think this is perhaps an area where people who are not involved might criticise.
Yes, they're quite right.
It goes on for 2 years and then it finishes. Part of the whole ethos of the project
is the dissemination. In fact, this type of programme and others on television, so we would be we hope that there will be good dissemination of the results.
Well, Professor Darmanin, thank you very, very much
thank
for coming on the programme.
Thank you very much.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.